Good morning to you. It is a Monday morning kicking off a brand new week with, I think we have to ask this question. And at what point are those in charge going to ask it? What's the cost of compassion? Like, what does compassion even look like? Because I don't see how this study tells us anything about compassion. But there's a study out that reveals opiates are killing 23 people a day, every day, in the year 2023. So that'll be worse for 2024. Overdose numbers, when you look between the years 2019 to 2021, doubled. So from 3,007 to 6,022. And one in four of all those deaths are aged 20 to 39. That is the age group with the largest increased percentage of deaths caused by opiates. I mean, it's crazy. 50% rise in that, but also followed by 20 to 29-year-olds who saw a 48% jump. So basically, those between 20 and 39 have seen a massive jump in drug deaths because we have normalized opiates and, frankly, made it easier for people to get them, despite the fact that people will say that's a safer way to go. Let's bring in Adam Szabo, director of the Canadian Center for Responsible Drug Policy, because I think you have definitely led the conversation on, you know, on a different conversation that we need to be having. Appreciate you joining.
Thanks for having me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Let's talk a little bit about this study, you know, that was done over a couple of years, a period of years, a year. When they looked, I guess, through the COVID years and what happened with opiate-related deaths and what the research showed them, and there was an explosion of overdose deaths. And so what do you take from this, parse from these numbers?
I mean, I don't think the study is telling us anything new. I think it's very well understood that COVID led to a significant rise in illicit drug use, which then caused a spike in deaths. We've seen that in data in provinces all throughout the country. I mean, the only really new thing here is an attempt to really quantify it. And it is unsurprising that deaths have doubled between 2019 and 2021, which only illustrates the need for more investment in solving the addiction crisis. Now, what I am concerned, though, by is that the authors are trying to advocate for certain harm reduction policies, mm-hmm. which are not supported by evidence, and they're basically artificially inserting support for these initiatives into their study, even though that advocacy has nothing to do with the data that they're analyzing.
Yeah, because these results will be published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, so they do carry some weight, but it again, what's the purpose of doing the study, and if it is to continue down this road and try to sell people that it's working, I don't know how they're going to sell it, because it's not.
Well, what they're essentially trying to argue is that the opioid crisis is crippling and it is killing an astounding amount of people, which is true. All of that is true. But then they're trying to advocate for a solution which they don't have evidence for, and I think that's the concerning part. I think that all of us can agree that having 22 people die every single day in Canada due to opioids is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I think we can all agree that this country is not doing enough to save people's lives. But what it looks like, you know, what saving lives looks like is up for debate. But I think that if you're going to, you know, take a study like this, which looks at hard data and is able to concretely show that, you know, deaths are rising, and then artificially insert into that advocacy for non-evidence-based solutions that seem to be only making the crisis worse, I think that's a little bit concerning, and I think it's a little bit misleading.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the numbers, and this is what we know only from 2023, 40,000 people have died since, I guess, 8 years when they decided to call this thing an emergency. So, you know, we're not... You know, we've got one side of the argument, Adam, who will say, well, if we didn't have safe supply and harm reduction, that number would be much, much bigger. But on the flip side, the part of the conversation that we are just starting to hear and what I think we need more of is if we had programs in place. Well, I mean, never mind putting aside the border controls and stopping fentanyl and all this stuff from coming through the borders and that. But if there's no support structures and or, you know, rehabilitation services, which there are very few of, we're only really having one. We can only have one conversation.
Well, that's the thing, right, is that we don't have robust rehabilitation services. If you want to go to rehab, you can either pay for a private rehabilitation center, which is incredibly expensive. I mean, we're looking at tens of thousands of dollars. So obviously that is not accessible to most Canadians. Or you can go through a publicly funded option, but that means waiting weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, if not months. And the problem is that people who are ready for recovery, they can't afford that. So they often, you know, relapse while they're waiting, or they die during that period. So obviously we need to invest more into treatment. Now, one thing that I thought was missing from the study that I thought was important to discuss is that we shouldn't just focus on overdose deaths. We have to talk about how people begin using drugs in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Because these researchers are very preoccupied with this, you know, illicit supply, the fact that the drugs that you buy on the streets may be unpredictable or contaminated and that might kill you. And so they advocate for the increased access to pharmaceutical opioids, which they believe are safer. And when you look at things narrowly, are safer compared to what you're buying on the street. But we're not really examining why is it that people are using drugs more often now than before. And most of the addiction physicians I've spoken with have said that a major factor here is increased availability of pharmaceutical opioids. And I think that if we talk about the addiction crisis and we don't talk about how having highly available pharmaceutical opioids creates new addictions, which then eventually lead to death, I don't think we're properly addressing the issue.
Well, right. But the other side of it is in your reporting, and only since that reporting have people admitted that, okay, safe supply is being now sold, you know, from the drug addict, you know, you're selling safe supply to the dealer who then takes it to a younger audience, maybe in the high schools and that, and they create a whole new generation of drug addicts. And so that side's also not talked about in this study.
Well, that's the thing, right? And it's partially because the study made no attempt to actually analyze the evidence base for safer supply. They just inserted it really artificially with almost no analysis to try to do advocacy instead of science, right? And it's concerning, right? I mean, the fact is that if we think that if we are concerned about people dying due to overdoses, we shouldn't just try to save their lives at the very end of their addiction. I mean, that's part of it. But that's only one part of the problem, right? We need to ask, how do we prevent people from getting addicted in the first place? How do we restrict access to drugs so that opioids are not abundant and cheap like they are now? There's a four-pillar approach to tackling the addiction crisis, and we are so overly focused on harm reduction that we often forget that prevention is just as important, if not more important.
Right. But again, we've completely moved away from that element getting into young kids' minds like we used to back in the day. You know, this is your brain on drugs, you know, cigarettes, those kind of things. We don't do those campaigns. They were actually very effective, I think, for certainly the generations today with smoking that. But they don't talk about that at all, right? It's not like, don't touch these drugs, because I almost think we've gotten used to saying, well, we've got a backup plan in case they do, which is not the way we should be looking at it.
Well, that's the thing, is that for many of these public health researchers and drug activists, they don't actually believe that drug use is inherently harmful. They think that it's the criminalization of drugs that it's bad, not the drugs themselves. So, for example, some of these harm reduction activists will genuinely argue that if heroin were legalized and people would use it safely and everything would be fine. Of course, that flies in the face of everything that we know about addiction and is ridiculous. But this is what they believe. And so they advocate quite aggressively for the normalization of drug use. They conceptualize it as a human right. And their frame of mind is incompatible with prevention initiatives, because when you advocate for prevention, you are, quote unquote, stigmatizing drug users, which is unacceptable for many of these activists.
Yeah. Well, again, by the time we, you know, if we have a change of government, because Polyev has campaigned on, you know, getting supports in place and going more the route of Alberta, which offers supports and rehabilitation. By the time that any of that comes in, we're talking years, right? Like, what does this look like in 5 years on the trajectory we're on now?
I mean, I don't think it's going to get better anytime soon, unfortunately. For us to build up our treatment capacity, which is something that we absolutely need to do, that will take years.
Yeah.
Alberta's been investing into this for years, and they're still not there. So I'm a bit of a loss. You know, if I had a solution, I think that would be amazing. But, you know, I don't have that knowledge. So we don't know exactly what to do. But what we do know is that flooding our streets with pharmaceutical opioids is not the solution.
No, and it is in search of many, many, many problems. Well, nonetheless, we'll talk about it. Appreciate your time. Thanks, Adam.
That's a pleasure speaking with you.
There you go. That's Adam Szivo, who really is, and of course, penned a huge investigation into this industry a few months ago, spent months on this, and presented a whole different amount of, you know, information and evidence of why these programs are not working. Okay, we've tried them. They're not working.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.